The Economist.
Warning lights are flickering across China's economy.
China's stock market tumbled for a third consecutive year in 2023. Its benchmark CSI 300 index of Shanghai and Shenzhen listed stocks dropped 11% last year and has extended its slide into the new year.
During previous Chinese stock market slumps, investors were at least able to take comfort in the knowledge that their property investments were probably doing well. In the first decade of Xi Jinping's leadership of the Chinese Communist Party, the country invested 427 trillion Chinese yuan in real estate, about 60 trillion US dollars in today's money. Now, the property market is shuddering too, with no signs of relief. There seems to be no safe haven for investors anywhere in China, and the pain is being felt everywhere at once.
Meanwhile, no end in sight to China's property malaise. Home prices falling the most in almost 9 years across 70 cities in the world's second biggest economy.
The impact of the property market seizure has hit China hard, much harder than it would anywhere else. That's because about 80% of China's household wealth is made up of housing assets, compared to more like a quarter in the US. And that is becoming a problem for economic growth.
China reported Q4 GDP expanding 5.2%. That happens to be the lowest level in decades.
So how much trouble is China really in? You're listening to Money Talks from The Economist, our weekly podcast on the markets, the economy, and the world of business. In Kuala Lumpur, I'm Mike Bird.
In Washington, D.C., I'm Alice Fulwood.
And in today's show, a look under the bonnet of China's economy.
First, we hear when things started to go wrong.
Midway through last year, it became pretty clear that the recovery from COVID was just not happening as expected.
Then we find out about the challenge facing President Xi.
How do you bust this bubble in such a way that the negative effects can be as minimal as possible?
Finally, we look at the country's new path and where it leads.
China realized that that growth at all cost approach was not something that was long-term sustainable.
Alice, hello.
Hi, Mike. No Tom today, then?
Apparently not. We are not yet even, I think, 6 weeks into 2024, and Tom is on his second holiday of the year.
Yeah, I really best get one booked in the calendar then. You know, gotta catch up. What are you up to in Kuala Lumpur?
It's a bit of Chinese New Year travel, but as you can see, I am still working. We've obviously got to take the rest of the year off and just leave it to Tom when he comes back.
But Mike, you've got us talking about China more broadly this week. Why is that?
So there's been no shortage of grim Chinese economic news recently. And perhaps more than anything else, that's been symbolized by the Evergrande saga. It's the Chinese property developer that a Hong Kong court has ordered to be liquidated recently. It's hard to overstate just how big Evergrande is, even today. Its website says it has over 1,300 projects in more than 280 cities ongoing. Most of those have been funded by Chinese home buyers who've paid upfront for apartments in those projects. They pay long before the project is finished. But in 2020, the government started to impose restrictions on the amount of money property developers could borrow. This is known as the Three Red Lines policy. And Evergrande, which was already a pretty fragile company in terms of borrowing ahead of its means, began to sort of come crashing down because of that.
And from what I've read, it sounds like, you know, Evergrande is the most obvious example of the wider problems with Chinese property rather than the sort of problem itself.
Yes, it's an incredibly broad story now. And as with any story about China's markets and China's economy, we wanted to speak to our man in Shanghai, Don Wineland. Don, thank you very much for joining us.
Happy to be here.
So, Don, it doesn't seem like all that long ago when we were talking about the huge boost to the global economy that we should expect from China's grand reopening after COVID. Yeah, that feels like a very long time ago. What happened and why does confidence in the economy seem to be in such a parlous state now?
Yeah, it's really amazing where we are today. I mean, if you go back a year ago, China was experiencing this massive wave of COVID infections, but the sentiment was actually quite positive on the ground. You know, China had just come out of this 1,000 days of being sealed off from the world. So despite all the infections at this time last year, people were rather positive on what 2023 would look like. But as you say, a year on, not a lot of that has really gone as planned. So about midway through last year, it became pretty clear that the recovery from COVID was just not happening as expected. You know, consumption was low. And of course, more than anything, the property market still continued to struggle. So yeah, in early 2024, things don't look great on the ground.
And all of this downturn in sentiment is really being reflected pretty clearly in the stock market, right?
That's right. Stocks in mainland China are down substantially since the start of the year. So the Shanghai Composite Index is down about 5 or 6% since the start of the year. Other indicators like the MSCI China Index at one point was down about 12%, which is pretty significant. And, you know, every day is a different story. This week, some of the indices closed upward. That's probably a sign that government funds were buying stocks. But basically, since the start of the year, more than $1 trillion have been wiped off of Chinese markets. If we're comparing to 2021, about $7 trillion have been wiped off of Chinese markets. So that's about 50%. Yeah, this is not great for sentiment on the ground here, and it's not great for the way that foreign investors look at China from the outside.
We've seen a lot of headlines recently related to one particular real estate company. Evergrande was China's largest property developer, and we've seen all this stuff about the consequences of its collapse. But the crisis in real estate goes quite a lot further than that. What's going on in the property market at the moment?
Evergrande has been the one company that people have watched to kind of signify where this crisis is going. But yeah, of course, the property crisis is much, much broader than that. There are thousands of property developers in China, and many of them are doing quite poorly this year. So the reason why there's such focus on this market is property developers contribute a very large chunk of Chinese GDP. So estimates vary, but it's usually cited as being somewhere between 20 and 30% of the economy. That's a lot. So when the property sector's in trouble, the entire economy is in trouble. There are different things going on here. There are different problems that can be found across the property sector. One of them is overbuilding. Chinese property companies have been overbuilding homes for many years. Many of them sit empty. And we've heard a lot over the past decade about Chinese ghost cities where there are just row after row of homes that have been built but not purchased. I've seen some of these. They're definitely out there. Another part of this crisis is that homes have been paid for, but they have not been completed. This is a more recent problem. As developers have lost access to capital, it's been harder and harder for them to complete the homes that they've already been paid to build. In China, most people pay upfront for their homes. So that means you have a lot of people out there who have paid for homes, but the property developers have not been able to complete them. So this is a bit confusing. You have, on the one hand, too many homes being built. And on the other hand, you have not enough homes being built. But you can't simply replace an overbuilt home that's in one city for a home that hasn't been completed in another place that somebody has already purchased. And don't forget, the crisis was brought on by Chinese regulation itself in 2020. The government tried to cut back on the amount of debt Chinese companies were allowed to take on. So when the government turned off the debt taps, property developers suddenly found themselves short on cash. So you have this crisis where there's a lot of overbuilding and then there's underbuilding and people aren't getting their homes. And the result is just utter lack of confidence in how the authorities deal with this problem over the next 2 years.
So taken together, we've got this very tepid economic recovery from the COVID lockdown era. You've got this huge slump in the stock market. You've got a lot going on in the property market as well. How bad is this overall? And does this feel really different from the sort of previous wobbles in the Chinese economy and Chinese markets that you've covered?
In a way, I would say it does feel a bit different from past downturns. So in 2015, the last time China had a major boom and bust cycle in the public equity markets, I remember that a lot of investors in the stock market were saying, sell your stocks, buy a home. So this just kind of goes back to how people had a lot of trust in the idea that housing prices would go up. They don't really have that option now. Nobody is chanting, sell your stocks, let's go plow our money into real estate. And I think that kind of gets at why this is a bit different now. The economy just looks very, very different from 2015 or even 2018. So it does feel quite a bit more pessimistic than downturns in the past.
Don, thank you very much for joining us.
My pleasure.
So that's where we are now. But to understand a bit more about how we got here and how Xi Jinping and his party might be thinking, I spoke to Yuanyuan Ang. She's the Alfred Chandler Chair of Political Economy at Johns Hopkins University and the author of two books on China's political economy. Yuanyuan Ang, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me.
In the last year or so, the investment climate and general sort of economic confidence in China at home and overseas has soured quite considerably. It doesn't feel like all that long ago that China was seen as a sort of exemplar of pretty rapid growth, and those are the terms that the country was discussed in. What happened?
The way I like to think about it is to use an analogy from U.S. history. The period of China's heady growth from the 1980s to the time Xi took over as the paramount leader, we can think of that as China's gilded age. So when we say China is the exemplar of rapid growth, we should keep in mind that that was also a period of rising inequality, endemic corruption, and financial bubbles. So we have now reached a point where I think it's safe to say that the bubble has burst or is bursting.
So in terms of the bubble bursting, we're talking about the real estate market or the sort of political model. Which do you mean by that?
So when Xi Jinping took over in 2012, he focused on tackling several excesses that were already building up in the system, one of which was the real estate bubble. His team carried out a series of deleveraging policies, imposing three red lines on real estate developers who were borrowing too much money to build these condominiums. That was intended to reduce the growth of overspeculation and risk in the system, but it was also the beginning of the bursting of the bubble.
So in the immediate aftermath of the global financial crisis in 2008, China gained a lot of attention because the Chinese government was doing precisely what Western governments weren't really doing, which was extremely large stimulus program. This feels like a sort of interesting counterexample to that sort of trend in which you have a Chinese government that seems very reticent to do large-scale stimulus at the moment in a period where, you know, Western governments did do that, especially during COVID. What do you think has changed?
First of all, the gigantic stimulus after the 2008 U.S. financial crisis was given out in an effort to prevent China from being dragged down by recessionary pressures coming from overseas. That stimulus was very effective. However, the downstream effect of that ginormous stimulus was that it actually made the financial and real estate bubbles larger. I think when she took over, the really difficult question is, you know that there's a bubble building up. How do you burst this bubble in such a way that the negative effects can be as minimal as possible. It is not possible to eliminate the bubble. It already is there. And these real estate developers, in their frenzy to make as much profit as possible, were taking on a lot of debt. They borrowed money to build, and oftentimes they promised home buyers that we would take your deposits first, and then we will deliver the apartments when it is ready. So it's called a pre-sale model. And when times were good, this model worked because people were buying, real estate developers had cash flow, and then they could use that money to deliver the apartments that they've promised. What happened is that once the central government began to limit the amount that the real estate developers could borrow, they began to experience a cash crunch. And with limited funds on hand, some of them found that they were no longer able to build the apartments that had already been sold. And that was a situation that you see in Evergrande. And these real estate developers, like Evergrande, had overextended. They went beyond real estate and started investing in things like mineral water, electric vehicles, things that had nothing to do with real estate. And it was really a case of capitalism gone wild. So when the three red lines were introduced, that was the beginning of an effort to burst the bubble in a controlled way, or at least that's what the central government had hoped. But the result of all of that is building up to the point we see today, which is that Evergrande became this symbol of the bursting of a bubble.
So why do you think the Chinese government hasn't done more to offset the real estate slump, to stimulate the economy?
Many people had expected that the real estate companies were too big to fail. They bought many apartments with the expectation that prices would never fall. So frankly, people have been surprised at the relative lack of a strong stimulus. And there's several things going on. The first, I think, is lesson learned from the past, that China has this problem on its hand today precisely because of the distortive effects of the ginormous stimulus, and they don't want to repeat that mistake. Second, I think that's also political ideology. Xi Jinping does not want to repeat what he sees as the decadent policies of Western capitalism, which includes government bailing out irresponsible capitalist companies like these real estate developers. And the third factor is, after the pandemic, local governments have been financially depleted, right? They no longer have the resources as they did in the past to give out more aid and subsidies. A fourth factor I would add is, I think, a psychological one, which is that Chinese policymakers have, for the last 40 years, only lived through boom times. Like, the only reality that they have ever known is that real estate prices only go up. They know how to deal with inflation. They know how to deal with runaway capitalism. But this is the first time that they've encountered something that looks like a recession. And I think psychologically, they're not prepared for that. I think it makes it easier to understand why they had been so slow to act in saving the real estate market. One could say that, in fact, the broad goal is not to save it. It is a long-term strategic plan to redirect economic growth away from real estate into higher value, high-tech sectors. And by the time Chinese policymakers realize that the situation is much worse than they thought, which is now, the effects of a vicious cycle have already set in, which is you now have this self-fulfilling prophecy in the real estate sector where people are not buying apartments because they're not confident. And because they're not buying apartments, real estate developers do not have cash. And because they do not have cash, they cannot deliver on the apartments they've promised. So now the big danger is that China is beginning to enter into this vicious cycle of negative expectations.
There's a sort of common view now among, I think, particularly Western economists, that what China needs to do now is to raise household consumption, that there has been too much sort of economic focus on investment. As you lay out, so much of it's gone into the real estate sector. There's maybe been too much of a focus, in their view, on exports as well, that you need higher household incomes, that might need reforms to welfare. It might need some sort of fiscal stimulus spending directed towards households. But it seems like the Chinese government is quite averse to doing that as well. Is there something in particular that makes that a sort of unpalatable option?
If you look at the US experience during the pandemic, the US government gave subsidies to households. It was effective in preventing a recession in the short term, but that was then rapidly followed by inflation. And from the perspective of the Xi leadership, they are wary of repeating the mistakes made by the West. The other side of it has to do with a bureaucratic logic. So if you think from the perspective of a Chinese bureaucrat, they are used to giving out money to their subordinates within the same bureaucratic system, right? So the central government would give fiscal transfers to local governments or to state-owned enterprises, and they in turn take actions to meet some kind of policy goals. Now, in that relationship, it's all within the house, and the bureaucrat feels that it is somewhat within his or her control. If they were to step outside of this system and give money directly to households, I think they would feel that this is beyond their control. And there's some truth to that. The Chinese bureaucrats are not going to be able to control if households will actually spend as they wish, bearing in mind that China is a very large country. Right? So if you were to give every household, say, $100, you'll have to multiply that by a very large factor. And it's not clear that giving each household $100 will be enough to spur them to go out and spend. So if you had to do household level subsidies, it probably would have to be a very large amount that the central government has to borrow.
Yuanyuan Ang, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me.
So, Alice, the thing that really strikes me here is precisely this political economy element. You know, we talk about the politics of China a lot, the economy of China a lot. It's good to sort of synthesize that. And I think to its credit here, there has in the past couple of years finally been some understanding within the Chinese government after a long period of excess borrowing in the real estate sector that this sort of credit pump priming model of the economy and a model of sort of stimulating the economy, while it was an easy way to boost the GDP figures, was starting to create a lot more problems than it was solving. And I think what's really interesting about what Yuanyuan Ang said is the reticence to boost consumption, which everyone in the sort of financial media and most Western economists talk about as the sort of obvious way for China to engineer a perhaps healthier recovery here. And I think it's really crucial because it's been strange to see it not happening. And it comes down to clearly all of these political and social risks. It's really interesting that there's an internal political explanation that makes sense, that reticence to lose control of how the money is being spent. And it makes a lot more sense when you sort of remember to yourself that you're talking about a one-party political system where control means everything, really. So it's great to get that sort of understanding of the political dynamics and how it helps to add to our understanding of what's happening economically.
Yeah, I was also sort of fascinated to hear her thoughts on why the Chinese government isn't doing more to support the economy. She mentioned that they were sort of worried about the inflationary risks that the rest of the world faced after heavily stimulating the economy after COVID. But I sort of wonder if they've slightly misjudged the relative risks here a bit. Obviously, this is a post-pandemic economy in China, but with all of the sort of property problems, it sounds a bit closer to what was happening in America in 2007-08 than just a clean comparison with America's post-pandemic economy. Now, obviously, no one in the rest of the Western world or in America enjoyed living through inflation. But if you were to ask economists or policymakers or whoever which problem they might rather be tasked with solving, the growth problems that America faced in 2009 or the inflation problems it had in 2022, I think the inflation problem is sort of a bit easier to get licked. So, I might err on the side of slightly too much stimulus for China right now rather than too little.
Yeah, it's a sort of tough balance to get right. I feel like everyone gets criticized regardless of which direction they end up going in. That is the difficult situation that the Chinese government finds itself in at the moment. But where there is a market in trouble, as the Chinese property sector very much is, there is also an opportunity for some investors. In this case, those who deal in distressed debt. Those investors, called vulture investors occasionally, a sort of unflattering term, argue that buying up non-performing loans and flushing the sort of excesses through companies like these can soften the overall impact of property crises and debt crises in general. To understand how, I spoke to Ben Fanger. He's American, but for more than 20 years, he's lived and worked in China, where he founded Shorevest Partners, an investment firm that specializes in Chinese credit. Ben, thank you very much for joining us.
Happy to, Mike. Thank you for having me.
So, Ben, tell us a little bit about Shorevest. And if possible, give us a sort of précis on what it means to be an investor in non-performing loans or distressed debt in general for listeners who might not be as familiar with that.
Shorevest is a private credit investor in China. We've been investing in debt in the country for over 20 years now. And in terms of a primer and what we do, so basically with credit investments, there's always various levels of seniority. So right now I'm sitting in a building. It probably has a senior loan on it, probably to a corporation. A bank in China or in most countries is going to have to sell that if that owner defaults on the loans. And the reason is that banks across the world are governed by Basel rules or similar rules that require them to hold performing assets. So they're supposed to be investing in loans that are performing, that are paying regularly. And the moment that something becomes a non-performing loan or is in default for 90 days or more, it's sort of like the bank holding a much riskier asset, say venture capital or some other kind of riskier asset. And that's really the regulatory impetus behind which the bank is going to want to sell that loan because they have to write it down anyway. It's hitting their tier one equity capital in a more onerous way. And so they have an incentive to sell it. And when they do sell it, they will be willing to take a price, generally willing to take a price that is some significant discount to the underlying collateral value, to the principal balance on the loan. It could be 20 cents on the dollar, it could be 50, it could be 70 cents on the dollar. It just depends on the quality of the loan.
Okay, so once you've identified a non-performing loan and you've gone out and bought it, how do you then exit the loan and sort of realize the return you were looking for?
Yeah, there's a number of different ways that you can rehabilitate a non-performing loan or turn it into a cash exit. One would be what people call a loan-to-own strategy, where they're buying the senior loan and through a court process or through a discussion with the borrower, they're actually taking title to the underlying building in lieu of the debt. A second way to exit a loan would be to begin a legal process where you are suing the borrower to repay you and then eventually going to ask the court to auction the building so that the general market can come and buy the building from which the proceeds go to paying back the senior loan. That approach can often result in a conversation with the borrower, which ultimately could be a settlement whereby the borrower offers to pay 50 or 60 cents on the dollar for something we paid 30 cents for, as an example.
So investing in distressed debt, distressed assets can be difficult enough, even if you're operating in a liberal democracy with a very transparent legal system. Obviously, buying these assets and getting the value out of them isn't that easy in the first place. You're doing this in China, and you have the extra difficulties on top of that, navigating the Chinese political and legal systems. How do you find that process?
We find the process of enforcing on first lien senior debt in China, by which I mean the senior mortgage on a building, quite predictable in China in general. There's going to be some exceptions to that that I can explain, but in general, China's legal system has really come a long way when it comes to enforcement of credit. And really, from a political standpoint, that matters a lot too for China. Beijing recognizes that most of the assets that its banks hold by far are just simply bank loans that are backed by buildings. And if that is not enforceable in a court in China, then you're sort of putting the entire banking system at risk. Also, if there isn't a legal system that works, nobody's going to come buy the non-performing loans when a bank needs to sell them. There are exceptions. So, of course, if the sale of the building is going to cause social unrest of some kind, for instance, you have to kick a bunch of people out of their homes. I mean, if it's an elderly long-term care facility that you're kicking elderly patients out of their beds, if you have to fire hundreds of employees in order to turn that building into cash, then of course it's going to get stuck in the process. But I don't think that that result is any different than what you'd find in Paris or even Chicago or other places in the world where a judge is going to be considering social issues.
So this seems like a fairly crucial element. When we were looking at the sort of policy settings in Beijing at the moment, there is clearly a very strong commitment to sort of rationalizing the real estate sector. Do you get the impression that the sort of approach from regulators and the legal system is keeping up with the sort of pace of the downturn in the real estate market?
Something that happened, I think, around 2016 or 17 is that the general approach that Beijing is taking made a major shift. And that shift was, in prior years, the kind of mandate was growth at all costs. So it didn't matter if a developer is building a bridge to nowhere or a ghost town, or if a venture capital firm is making billionaires, you know, right and left. If as long as you're producing growth, then you're good. But China realized that that growth at all cost approach was not something that was long-term sustainable. And so what we saw is a shift in the regulatory approach to be balancing reasonable growth against what they call Wei Wen, which is long-term stability. So this is stability of the financial system, stability of the real estate markets, and social stability as well. And so when we take into account these kind of longer-term health questions, then certain pain needs to be taken more immediately. And I think the approach to the three red line policy and making it difficult for property developers to just get all the bank loans they want whenever they want to build whatever they want, that approach was really one of those short-term pain for longer-term health kinds of decisions. And also, I think it's produced a kind of sobriety in the expectations with respect to how real estate values appreciate in China, which is a good thing. You know, when we're talking to a counterparty about a building's value, we're not getting the answer, oh, don't worry, it's just going to double in price tomorrow. They're much more rational in the international kind of capital market sense where, okay, does it have cash flow or not? Is there a cap rate or not? These kinds of more fundamentally driven questions as to the value of real estate are very common in China today, but they were not common 10 years ago.
So the individual case that I suppose has made the most headlines globally is that of Evergrande, partly because it was, I suppose, watched for so many years by the financial media. It was a company that had this breakneck expansion and a spectacular collapse. What can we learn from Evergrande about how this difficult process of winding back some of these excesses is going to be? Are there opportunities there for investors like yourself? How do you see what's going on at the moment?
Yeah, I think Evergrande and what has transpired over the last few years is good in the sense that it's a reminder to global capital markets of a couple of important things. One, China is not a place that's just going to continue to be hockey stick growth. It's just like any other major economy. It's going to have its cycles. And particularly when the government is concerned about long-term health of the economy and stability, we're not going to just see all outcomes be without default or insolvency or other things that investors see in a downturn. Also, we can learn from the Evergrande situation to focus on the seniority of your position in the potentiality of a liquidation. So if you're a first lien senior bank loan on Evergrande's building in China, you're probably going to be paid in full because you come first in the capital stack. But after that first loan gets paid back, as Evergrande's assets get liquidated, you know, next comes other unsecured creditors onshore in the PRC mainland. So that would be unpaid wages, construction liens, and so forth. And then after all of these things get paid back in the operating entity in the mainland, whatever is left to be distributed to the Hong Kong holdco that to which the offshore bonds were lending money then gets distributed to them.
So one big issue in Chinese real estate is that a lot of the effectively creditors to the real estate companies are home buyers. We've talked on the show before about how the model of pre-sales in China, in which a home buyer will purchase a property often several years before it's actually built. If the property company gets in trouble in the interim, that's a big deal for anyone who's put down a lot of money for their home. What happens to those people? Are we sort of finding out where they sit in the capital stack?
From a legal standpoint, as I mentioned earlier, Evergrande, as most Chinese companies that has issued bonds offshore, has an onshore operating company in the mainland of the PRC. And that company and all of its creditors really come first. So those creditors would not only include the bank loans that are senior on the real estate assets or unsecured loans that the company has taken out from banks, but it would also include other payables, such as payables to employees, contractual obligations that the company has, including to home buyers. I don't know whether the result would be to pay those home buyers their deposits back or to make sure that the homes get finished and they can be delivered their homes. But in any case, that all comes prior to proceeds that'll be distributed offshore to Hong Kong to pay back offshore creditors. But then there's the policy question of what does it make the most sense for China to make sure happens? And as I mentioned earlier in the conversation, China's kind of really significant current focus to me seems to be that they're trying to balance reasonable growth with another countervailing or equally important objective, which is stability. And that stability includes both financial system stability, which is why they would sell lots of non-performing loans out of the banks, but also social stability. And social stability is going to mean that someone that buys a home should get a home, right? And especially you could kind of identify situations where there could be a social consideration when you think of a situation that could cause protests. If something's going to cause mass protests, it's very likely that the government is going to try to find ways to mitigate that risk of social unrest. And so in this situation, I think we've seen the Chinese government doing things to, like setting up funds to make sure that homes get completed so they can be delivered to home buyers. This is the kind of thing you're going to see. You're going to see stimulus that's targeted at mitigating the risk of social unrest. You're not going to be seeing, at least in my estimation, you're not going to be seeing stimulus that's targeted to save unsecured offshore bondholders.
Ben, thank you very much for joining us on Money Talks.
Thank you, Mike. Pleasure to be here.
So, Alice, what do you make of all this? After hearing everything Ben had to say, are you considering a sideline career in distressed Chinese debt?
One of my highlights from his interview was how quickly he went from saying that he rehabilitates alone, which sounds, you know, kind of cuddly, to the methods by which he does that, one of which is to sue the borrower, which doesn't sound cuddly at all. I personally wouldn't call them vulture investors, but I did think that was pretty, I was pretty tickled by that. I guess my big sense here is he was talking about how the Chinese have sort of come to a realization about their economic model, this growth at all costs, credit pump priming the economy to sort of build all this infrastructure and houses and things that don't necessarily sort of provide real economic value. They sort of come to the realization that maybe that is not an effective and sort of long-term model. Hearing that, hearing about all the problems that China's currently facing in its property sector, how, you know, growth is slowing down. We've also had the news that China's population is now actually shrinking. Population control policies were so effective, and it hasn't been able to reverse those trends, that it is now actually getting smaller. You know, it is starting to feel like we might be living through a repeat of the infamous Paul Samuelson textbook moment. So for listeners who aren't familiar, in 1961, Paul Samuelson, who went on to win a Nobel Prize in economics, published a textbook on growth. Included in it was a chart of sort of expected sizes of economies in the US and in the Soviet Union. And it showed the Soviet Union sort of powering ahead with its economic model and sort of eclipsing America and eventually becoming the sort of biggest economic hegemonic power. And that obviously didn't happen. Its sort of economic model fell apart. And I don't think we're quite at that stage in China where you can say that all of the sort of wheels are coming off. But I do think you are starting to see from investment banks who were predicting the sort of relative sizes of America and Chinese economies that actually they're now not necessarily forecasting that China will ever overtake the US. The sort of faith or belief that that was the economic destiny of these two countries does really seem to have been undermined by sort of all of these developments, all of these sort of issues that China is facing now. And that is a sort of real sea change from how we've been thinking about China for a very long time. So I'll be fascinated to see how it plays out. Maybe in 2 years, everything will be all smoothed over and we'll feel like idiots for even considering this. But at the moment, it feels like, you know, maybe we've reached that kind of moment again.
It's a bit of a spoiler alert there for anyone waking up from a 35-year coma who didn't know how the Soviet Union ended from Alice. I totally get that. And it's sort of fascinating how quickly these things can change. And I think that's especially true when you're talking about sort of relatively authoritarian single-party political systems. What has really fascinated me in the last few years is that if you'd been talking to people in sort of 2018, 19, there was this huge amount of lip service to the idea of crushing these speculative excesses in the real estate sector. And Xi Jinping talked about houses are for living in, not for speculating. But they didn't really do much about it. You know, huge volumes of credit flowed into the real estate sector. Everyone invested very heavily in housing, people borrowing to buy second and third homes and leaving them empty, all this crazy stuff. And now they really, really are doing a lot about it. And they're doing a lot about it at really considerable visible cost. You can see it every day in the equity market, this sort of incredibly poor sentiment that is flooding through really from the housing sector. And you've gone from this supercharged credit channel Keynesian approach to the economy to this sort of Austrian style austerity to flush out the malinvestment. And it's been done as a handbrake turn in the space of 2 or 3 years by all the same people that were doing the sort of stimulus before. And I guess that gets to what I find so sort of unusual or almost self-defeating, which is that the Chinese government has sort of gone for all the stick and none of the carrot. So one lesson that they've clearly learned from other financial blowups internationally is that you need to clear the backlog of distressed and non-performing debt quickly, clean up those balance sheets, the sort of thing that Ben was talking about there, or you might nurse the economic consequences for years and your financial institutions won't work very well. But while they're hammering the real estate sector with these funding constraints and making the way for a cleanup, the alternatives that they're making room for are either non-existent or pretty limited. There's a lot of focus on new tech and advanced manufacturing, things like solar and batteries and EVs. They're just not anywhere near big enough to replace the sort of stimulus, the sort of economic activity that was done through the real estate sector. Chinese local governments, we've spoken about this before, make a lot of their revenue from land sales. They're getting hammered, and nobody's put in place what their alternative method of financing is meant to be. So you've got this huge plank being withdrawn from the Chinese economy, to some extent what it's been built on for decades now, and nothing being put back in its place. So it's a sort of half-baked transition with all of the painful content and none of the sort of upside of having something else to do.
Yeah, I mean, that all sounds pretty bad to me. I am similarly gloomy about how this is all going to play out for China.
I will be very keen to see whether they sort of hang on to it, because if there's one thing we saw, particularly during the COVID era, it's that when there genuinely does seem to be a risk to the political side of things, you know, when you saw those protests towards the end of the zero COVID policy, things can change very, very quickly, which is, you know, I guess another part and parcel of having a sort of political system that's concentrated, not just in a single party, but to a large extent in a single man. I think that's about all that we have time for, except for our stats of the week. Alice, what do you have for us?
My stat of the week this week is $252 million, which is the loss that New York Community Bank posted on January 31st. Now, $252 million is obviously not an amount of money to be sneezed at, but you know, this bank has $110 billion in assets. It has sort of $10 billion of capital. So it's only about 2% of its sort of total capital buffer. But this news has led to a 65% slide in its share price over the past week or so since it reported earnings. And I think it gets to just how much investors hate the idea of owning banks. The bank sort of doesn't really seem to be bust. Its bonds are still trading as though it's going to exist for a long time.
I smell the grains of a future episode here. I think we might be back again to talk about US banks at some point in the near future. My stat of the week is a little bit happier than that, and it is 500 billion. It's 500 billion yen, which at that level is still real money, even in yen. It's the promised buybacks from Mitsubishi Corp, the sort of old school Japanese conglomerate. It's not the car maker, it's the sort of bigger conglomerate company. And basically, this company has announced a large buyback, and the share price has really popped. It's up by about 80% in the last year or so. And again, even in yen terms, even accounting for a bit of yen weakness, that's a huge amount. And this is really speaking to what we were talking about a couple of episodes ago, which is the sort of Japanese corporate governance story. This was, for a long time, considered the sort of company that in Japan was a real value trap, you know, poorly run, too many different lines of business, too much going on, that is really, really doing well now. It's benefited, obviously, from attention as well from Warren Buffett, bringing some international investors in. But yeah, slightly happier news from Japan.
You know, I feel like this could be almost like our Groundhog Day episode of Money Talks. Chinese property is in trouble, American banks are in trouble, and Mike has done a stat denominated in yen. Fictional money. You know, that's going to be the trifecta. We just play this episode on repeat forevermore.
I'm thinking of using yen as my new base currency for everything, just because it sounds more impressive. You know, I'll say that, you know, the British government budget redenominated in yen. I think there's something to it. We should tag a couple of zeros onto most things.
Campaign to get it in the style guide. All figures in yen,
yes.
Sounds more impressive. That's what people want when they come to The Economist.
Absolutely. Absolutely. With that, I would like to thank Yuanyuan Ang and Ben Fanger for joining us.
And thank you for listening to Money Talks.
You can always write to us at podcasts@economist.com.
Today's show is produced by Dan Asher and Marie Keyworth.
Our sound engineer is Saul Rivers.
And the executive producer is Marguerite Howell.
I'm Mike Bird.
I'm Alice Fullwood.
And this is The Economist.